Well, this is the first of the Abraham's Offspring, An Introduction to Islam for Christians. Session number one, the Muslims are coming, confronting stereotypes of Islam. I thought since this is a Christian retreat center, it would be worthwhile to begin with a moment of prayer. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, Alhamdulillah, Rabbil Alameen, ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, most compassionate, most merciful, all praise be to God, owner of the worlds, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Well, Islam, an introduction for Christians. What you just heard was part of the Quran. Probably coming from a Christian background, hearing that would sound like it fit, that that same God is being described. So that's why I wanted to start with that. Also, realize that this is my first time at Holden Village. My understanding is that it was founded by Lutherans, and so I thought it would be fitting to tell a Lutheran joke to begin with. It has absolutely nothing to do with my but it's the old one about how many Lutherans does it take to screw in a light bulb. Well, there's an old answer and a new answer. The old answer is 10. To form a committee, and they'll get back to you in 2 years with a recommendation. The second answer, how many Lutherans does it take to change a light bulb is, change?
Yeah.
My name is Volker Greifenhagen, and I teach religious studies at a college called Luther College at the University of Regina. That's located in Regina, Saskatchewan, which is one of the western provinces of Canada, just above Montana and North Dakota. And my area there is teaching Islamic studies mainly. I also teach some courses in the Hebrew Bible and world religions in general. So I have an academic interest in this subject of Islam and how Christians can understand Islam. But I'm also a pastor, an ordained pastor in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Canada. I work in campus ministry, teaching at the seminary, and even though I'm now mainly doing academic work, I end up being called on many times, more than I need to go out into parishes and preach, supply preach, and so on. So I also have a pastoral interest in this area. And it's my conviction that Christians cannot afford to remain ignorant or isolated from the world's other great religious traditions. And furthermore, that Christians, rather than being threatened by others who believe differently, can find in the faith of others both a source of learning and inspiration, as well as a challenge to their own Christian faith in all its fullness. So that's just general introduction. Now, why Islam, though? What is it about Islam that I think is important? Well, three and maybe four reasons why I think why I'd like to focus on Islam in particular. First of all, Islam is important to Christians because of sheer numbers. All right? Islam is clearly, after Christianity, the largest world religion. There are over 1 billion people in the world today who claim to be Muslim as adherents of the religion of Islam. And that means about 1 in every 5 people, at least in the world, are Muslims. And as well, Islam is growing at a tremendous rate. Now, I have figures mainly for the West and mainly in Canada, because that's where I do most of my work. I think it's fairly similar in the U.S., though. Between the 1981 census and the 1991 census, the number of Muslims in Canada tripled. You know, a lot of that was immigration. In other parts of the world, it's birth rate, and there's also conversion to Islam as a big factor in this. And the projections are that Islam will be soon in both Canada and the U.S., the second biggest religious group. It will outpace Judaism very soon, and Muslims will constitute the next biggest religious group other than Christians in both Canada and the U.S. So what this all means, of course, is that Muslims are increasingly our neighbors. Right? It is not unheard of for a mosque to be built next to a church, or for Muslims to use a building that used to be a church for a mosque or something. I know examples of all these type of arrangements. It's not unheard of now for your neighbor across your back fence to be a Muslim, or for your work colleague to be a Muslim. So that's probably the first reason that I think it's important for Christians to know something about Islam. They're our neighbors. Muslims are neighbors. But secondly, Islam is important to Christians because it is increasingly prominent in world affairs. Much has been made in the media of the phenomenon of Islamic revival or resurgence in the world. And the words Islam and Muslim are often paired with images of extremism and terrorism. Now that the threat of communism and the Soviet Empire have passed, new enemies are identified. In a very widely circulated and discussed article, the political scientist Samuel Huntington spoke of a new clash of civilizations. Now, admittedly, he also spoke about Chinese, Japanese, and Hindu civilizations, but it's very clear from the article that his greatest anxiety centers on Islam. Okay? Islam has bloody borders, he asserts, and he urges Western policymakers to contain this new threat to Western civilization. And the fact is that in many parts of the world, Muslims, where they are in the majority, choose to follow a course that differs in important respects from what is considered right and proper in Europe and North America. And again, why is this important for us? Well, if Christians truly believe that their faith is good news, not just for Europeans and North Americans, but for the whole world, then it behooves us to know something about what Muslims believe and aspire to. But then probably the third most important reason, Islam is important to Christians because Islam and Christianity in many ways come from the same family, speak the same language, and share many similar concepts, and as well have a very long history of relationship. Not often that good. I was very intrigued by the theme chosen for this summer at Holden Village. If I can remind you, it's from Paul's letter to the Galatians in chapter 3, verses 20 to 29, where he says, "There is no longer Jew or Greek, there is no longer slave or free, there is no longer male and female, for all of you are one in Christ Jesus. And if you belong to Christ, then you are Abraham's offspring, heirs according to the promise." It's all going back to Abraham. Well, one of the things that Muslims claim and strongly assert is that Abraham is their forefather too. And so maybe the provocative question in light of the theme of this summer that I would raise, are Muslims also heirs according to promise? Traced back to Abraham. And there's some very interesting things we could talk about there in the Quran, where Muslims would argue that Abraham was neither Jewish or Christian. He came before that. Oh, so Jews or Christians have no exclusive claim on this figure. So, both Islam and Christianity speak of one God, of mercy and forgiveness, of judgment, of resurrection, of a moral life, and of social justice. Jesus and many other New Testament and Old Testament personalities are revered figures in Islam. Now, in fact, probably because for Christians, Islam has been the largest other world faith closest at hand, both geographically and conceptually, that these two traditions have had a very troubled relationship over the centuries. After all, the neighbor who is problematic is rarely the neighbor who's far away and very exotic, right? That's the neighbor you go visit and and take in the exoticness. The neighbor who's problematic for you is the one that's right next door and is very similar to you, but has that little bit of a difference that just gets you. And so Christians and Muslims have had this long history of up and downs, culminating even in today. And I said there was a fourth reason, perhaps, that Christians should be concerned or know something about Islam. I'm not that serious about this fourth reason, but again, I go back to the fact that this is a retreat center coming out of the Lutheran tradition, or at least the Reformation tradition, and it's probably not that off to assert that historically, Lutheranism and Protestants would not be around today if it wasn't for Islam. In other words, the Reformation may never have succeeded without the threat of the Turks. And these were the Muslims who were coming up in Eastern Europe. They'd taken over Hungary, and in 1529, in the thick of the Reformation, they besieged Vienna. And this was, and so they were a real threat to the German principalities and states, and the Emperor Karl V, or whatever, whoever it was at the time, could not afford to alienate the evangelical provinces and principalities. He needed, because they might make a pact with the Turks, and then he was in real big trouble. So there's a very good possibility that he allowed the Reformation to proceed in those areas and didn't, you know, kind of squelch it out because of Islam. So that's another another reason. But now I'd like you to be part of this here. Now that we're sort of, I want to focus on Islam today and our perceptions of it and the kind of stereotypes that are around. And so what I'd like you to do is I want you to think, if you have something to write on, you can write on or just remember it in your head. I'd like you to think of an answer to two questions I had. One is, what country in the world would come to your mind as having the hugest bulk of Muslims living in? Like, what country in the world has a lot of Muslims? Okay, just, and you know, don't worry about getting it right or wrong. This is not a test that you have to pass. All right? So think of that. What country? Think of one country in the world that you think there must be an awful lot of Muslims. The most Muslims that live within a country live in this country. All right? And the second question to think of is, what language do you think most Muslims in the world speak? So do you want to take just a minute and think of an answer to those things? If you can, you can write it down so you don't forget it. Usually students have paper, so they write it down and ask them to trade with one another so they feel freer to give the answer out, because it's not their own, you see.
Don't worry about that here.
Okay, well, I won't worry about that here. So those are your two questions here. The largest number of Muslims in the world live in whatever, and most Muslims in the world speak. Okay, now this is going to be really interesting to try to write here. I don't think they're really set up for overheads. I teach with overheads all the time, so. So let's see what you said. The largest number of Muslims in the world live in? Iran, Saudi Arabia.
Indonesia.
Okay, Indonesia. Iraq.
India.
India,
Pakistan.
Pardon? Pakistan, mm-hmm.
China.
Any other suggestions?
Turkey.
Oh, I guess you're supposed to be able to read this. Pardon?
Egypt.
Mm-hmm. Any others you want to guess?
The U.S. down.
USA, okay, sure.
Sudan.
Okay, that's a good list. Very good list, all right? What about most Muslims in the world speak? What?
Parsi?
Arabic? Any other suggestions? Pardon?
I don't know what they speak in
English. Okay. Well, in anything that you would guess. I mean, pardon? Malay, somebody said? Okay. Okay, I mean this is a good enough list, but
Pakistan.
Pakistani, okay.
Urdu.
Pakistani, yeah. That's right. We just put that together like that, yeah. The more important question, rather than whether you got it right or wrong, is to ask, how do you know? Well, no, but how do you, from what sources or experiences do you have enough to go on to at least suggest an answer?
Life.
We lived in the Middle East.
Oh, you lived in the, okay, personal experience. Mm-hmm. Wow, where did you live?
We lived in Saudi Arabia and Sudan and Oman.
Oh, okay, wow. Okay, well that's real rubber hitting the road experience, yeah. Most of us probably don't have that that behind us. What for others who have not had a chance to live there?
Daughter's friend's family.
Okay, you've got some sort of you know some people through other people. And can you say a little bit more about
Our daughter's best friend back in school, her family fled Iran during the
revolution. Okay, yeah.
And the girl's father is not a practicing Muslim, but that's what he would claim to be.
Yeah.
The daughter, though, is now Christian.
Did you suggest Iran as a? Okay, see, that makes sense, doesn't it? Because you have that connection.
The media.
Media. Okay, can you say some more about that?
What's going on in the Philippines,
okay,
with Muslims, just little things, that uprisings that have to do with the Muslim.
Okay. Uprisings?
And mostly negative.
Okay.
Unless there's violence, you probably don't hear about it.
Okay.
What I've heard through the media was most of the time negative.
Okay. So whatever news reports kind of get filtered through, you're talking about mainly, when you're talking about media, you're mainly thinking of news media, right?
News.
Television and maybe the newspaper or radio,
right,
and the reports you're getting. And so somehow you hear words of countries or you hear Islam or Muslims in some sort of context. How many others is that true in terms of maybe the answers that you would put down, like Egypt or Sudan or Indonesia or whatever? You've probably heard news from various areas, and you start associating Islam with certain areas, and then beyond that with certain actions or dispositions. Well, any other media that might affect you? Yeah.
Like information from different Christian mission organizations, like radio broadcasting to Morocco or Africa.
Okay. So you've got a different kind of media.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, movies like Not Without My Daughter and
okay.
the book Guest of the Revolution. And,
okay.
Some of these movies, the thriller terrorist ones.
Right.
You know, the Muslims are never good guys.
That's right. Executive Decision is always a favorite one that comes up. Cartoons.
Oh, yeah.
Aladdin. Right, yeah, of course, yeah, right. Okay. Yeah, so, I mean, some people have had more personal contact, lived there, you know some people. Maybe others of you know Muslims or know Muslims through others. But probably for the majority of Westerners, and certainly it's true of the majority of my students, their perceptions of Islam have been largely shaped by what they get through the media. News media and also entertainment media like movies and so on, yeah.
Well, because I've never been in any of these places, I discover I was sitting here thinking, golly, I think Nigeria has a lot of Muslims. I wonder how big Nigeria is. Is it bigger than Pakistan? Could you fit more people into Nigeria?
Well,
maybe Pakistan's got more. Now, wait a minute, how big is...
Well, we're gonna get have the right answers.
Yeah.
We're gonna reveal the right answers. Here.
And I have no personal picture of any
yeah.
of these places. I'm thinking of a world map, and I'm trying to figure out which projection was I looking at, and which were those countries, and were they, you know, were they populations? And I just don't have a very firm picture because I've never been there.
Okay. You've never been there, but I'd also might suggest that also you might have an idea of the world that's based on where news reports tend to come from. So you might have a lot of knowledge about certain areas. And I mean, obviously, the news usually focuses on our local area or our country. But in terms of international news, you might hear a lot about a certain place, and suddenly that is on the map for you. But the rest is not there. Well, if I was to, I usually do this too, but I don't want to spend a lot of time on this one. But if I was to say, you know, when you hear the word Muslim or Islam, what kind of words, images come to mind? What might be some of the things you'd say? Because all of you know something. Now, whether it's correct or distorted or right or wrong, I mean, that's a whole other thing. But we all know something about Islam already. So Muslim, Islam, I say that. What comes to mind?
Spiritual.
Sorry, what was that one? I didn't get both of them were at the same time.
Was you?
I was at Farrakhan.
Farrakhan, okay, yes. What and what did somebody else say over here?
What the women are.
Okay, the veiled women. Okay.
No education for women.
No education for women.
There's one God, Muhammad is his prophet.
There's one God, Muhammad is his prophet. What other things come to mind? Yeah.
Devotion and discipline.
Devotion and discipline.
Holy war.
Holy war, yes. We even have the word jihad has become part of the English language, and in a very negative way, right? Everybody thinks jihad means holy war. Doesn't, but we associate that, right? Yeah.
Little boys sent off with rifles to enter into paradise.
Right.
Martyrs.
Yes. Martyrs, yeah. Violence.
Yeah. Women are property of their husbands.
Women are property of their husbands, yeah. So, I mean, you know, I'm getting, most of them are negative things that come up, right? They specifically center especially around violence and a whole set of issues like the boys and martyrdom and holy war and terrorism and what have you, and gender. Okay, very often stuff about women. Are women owned? Why do they have to? Why are they covered up? Why aren't they? You know, all that sort of stuff. Okay. That fits into that same thing. Yeah, about gender stuff. Yeah. Yes, right. So there are a lot of these images that we have. Well, I'd like to let's look at see how accurate, in quotation marks, our perceptions as a group were of these basic questions, which in themselves are not that threatening, but the violence and gender ones are, of course, far more pertinent. So let's just have a look. The true answers will now be revealed. Okay. So let's do the countries first. So the country with the largest Muslim population is, and I have to commend some people in this room, Indonesia. Okay, Indonesia has at least 186 million Muslims. Indonesia is a very big, very populous country. This is not the entire population of Indonesia, by the way. At least over 10% of the population are of different faiths, a lot of Christians, a number of Hindus as well, especially those two faiths also exist in Indonesia. But in terms of absolute numbers, Indonesia has the most number of Muslims living within the borders of one country. Now, it's very interesting because for many people, that was surprising, at least until a little while ago, because all of a sudden Indonesia was in the news a little bit, right? There were all the fires in Indonesia, and then there was the stuff about the overthrow of Suharto, and then the tensions now between Muslims and Christians in the Spice Islands, and then the Philippine stuff that's right next door. So you hear a little bit more about it, so people are starting to twig in the fact that, hey, there are a lot of Muslims living in this area. But before that time, nobody would have thought of that, really, because it wasn't on the map that you had from the media, unless you had been there, right? So, okay. So that's the biggest one. Then Pakistan comes next. 144 million Muslims living in Pakistan. And Pakistan is pretty largely, virtually all Muslim. There are some minority groups there. Bangladesh. Nobody said Bangladesh, but on the third on the list is Bangladesh with 124 million Muslims. These are huge numbers, eh, of people. Now, somebody did say India. 114 million. Now that is a minority in India. All right, but it's a pretty big minority, and so it's very significant. So you see, here we have the three countries of the Indian subcontinent, and three of the most populous Muslim countries, countries with big Muslim populations, are all within the Indian subcontinent. In fact, one out of every five Muslims in the world today lives on the Indian subcontinent. And that's significantly east of where most people think most Muslims live. Right? It's interesting. But in Indonesia, of course, farther east. Okay, now somebody said Iran. So there you've got, you're right about that. That's pretty big, 74 million. Very explosive population, very fast-growing population in Iran. Now, I'm very glad that, who mentioned Nigeria? Very good. A lot of people, they think of North Africa. You know, they'll think of Morocco and Egypt and maybe the a bit of East Africa, Sudan, Algeria and so on. But they don't think of sub-Saharan Africa as having a large Muslim presence. But Nigeria, which is the most populous country in Africa, it's got a huge population. And 72 million Muslims live there. They constitute probably half, maybe a little bit more than a half, maybe a little less than a half. It all depends who's reporting the figures, for what reason are Muslim in Nigeria. All right, sub-Saharan Black Africa. Turkey, that was a good suggestion, 67 million Muslims. And I've just got a few more just so you sort of know where this is going. Egypt, 64 million Muslims. So here we're now more in the traditional place where a lot of people think a lot of Muslims live, right? Algeria, North Africa, 32 million. Morocco, 31 million. And finally,
Saudi Arabia.
No. Somebody said China.
Yeah.
Somebody said China. Now that was a very good observation. Again, 30 million people in China is a drop in the bucket. But I always remind my Canadian audiences that there are more Muslims living in China than there are Canadians living in Canada. So that always seems pretty significant to them. That's a pretty big minority of Chinese people who are Muslim, right? Okay. Now, Saudi Arabia will be way down at the bottom because Saudi Arabia is not a very populous country. You know, it swells by a million or two every time there's the pilgrimage season, but for the rest of the time, it's one of the least populated, you know, smallest populated countries. It's not very densely populated. Same with a lot of the other countries of the Middle East that people think of. Some people think of Iraq, or they think of Syria, or Jordan, or the Gulf, the Emirates, you know. But these places are all very heavily Islamic, but their population is really quite small. So in absolute numbers, they don't register. Now let's look at the language situation. Okay, somebody did mention Urdu. I mean, that's a little bit of a distortion, but remember that about at least one out of three Muslims lives on the Indian subcontinent. I said one out of five, that was incorrect. About a third of Muslims live in the Indian subcontinent. They don't all speak Urdu, but that's a good kind of standard language to talk about. They also speak various other Indic languages, such as Punjabi, Kashmiri, Bengali, Gujarati, Sindhi, Telugu, Tamil, and Malayalam. These are all big languages in the Indian subcontinent. People need to realize that India has, I don't know how many official languages, about 8 or 10 official languages. That doesn't count all the unofficial dialects. But this is a reflection of the fact that most, one-third of Muslims live in the Indian subcontinent, and they don't speak Arabic as their daily language at all. They speak one of these languages. Now, Arabic was a good guess. But notice, only about 18% of Muslims are Arabic speakers. That is people who speak Arabic as their natural language. So in about 1 out of 5, about 20% of Muslims live in what we think of Arabic countries. That's all North Africa and the Middle East. Okay. So these are people who would use Arabic as their mother tongue. Now this is not to say that Arabic isn't important to Muslims. The Scripture of Islam is in Arabic, And most Muslims make, and the prayers in Islam are said in Arabic too. So most Muslims who are, you know, want to practice Islam will try to learn some Arabic, enough to be able to at least to recite the prayers, the formal canonical prayers. And some will go on to even memorize the Quran, learn how to recite the Quran, and so on. But that does not mean that their language that they speak is Arabic. Then somebody said Malay. That's that Malay or related languages are spoken in Indonesia. I think Indonesia actually, Bahasa Indonesian is the way they talk about their language. Javanese is another language spoken there. Okay. Then Swahili. People didn't realize this reflects the strong presence of Islam in Eastern Africa, all the way down south of the Sudan and Tanzania and Uganda and Kenya, and into South Africa and so on. Very strong Muslim population there. Again, the relative numbers are smaller in those countries, so they didn't register on this side. Turkish languages are spoken by about 11% of Muslims. And finally, Persian, or Parsi, somebody said. Persian and related languages like Pashto, Baluchi, Kurdishi, and so on, are spoken in Iran and surrounding areas like Azerbaijan and Tajikistan and so on, and Afghanistan. Now, if we put a map of the world on here, just to kind of reiterate this, again, a third of the Muslims in the world live right here in the Indian subcontinent, right? Pakistan, India, and Bangladesh. Over half of the world's Muslims, if I put this pen down here, between Iran and Pakistan, right here, half of the world's Muslims live on this side of that line. Over half of them live further east than most people think. They would be led to believe they live by, you know, what they get through the media and so on, which is in the Middle East and Africa and so on. Okay? And all this is to say, I mean, this is a simple kind of geography lesson. But what all this is to say is if the impressions you get from whatever sources they are, usually the media sources, of where most Muslims live and what languages they speak is not quite accurate, then it also behooves us to question the other perceptions we have of Islam through the media and other sources, particularly the perceptions of Islam or the associations of Islam or Muslims with violence on the one hand and with gender issues, like oppression of women on the other hand, okay? I mean, all I'm saying here is that, you know, if our perceptions of civil geography are not quite accurate, maybe our perceptions of those kind of things which we get through the media are not that accurate either, and we need to re-examine them. Let's make sure how much time we have. I have two other things that I just want to do very quickly, and I'd like to have time to discuss. I have a few more images to show you, and then I have a very short video to show you, which was done by a Muslim, and it's a spoof on Muslim stereotypes. And then let's talk about some of them. But, I mean, here's a typical example of what you get in the media, right? Okay, this is my favorite. It's from the Durham Herald Sun. This is when I lived in North Carolina, and just when the peace process started getting underway. This is and Islamics is not even a word. I mean, Muslims practice Islam. Islamic is an adjective, you know. There is Islamic architecture or Islamic, you know, a scripture or something, but there is no such thing as Islamics walking around. So this was I like that one because it's so bad. Okay, but you know, this is another typical example. This is from the Atlantic magazine once. The roots of Muslim rage. Look at that, you know. Look what the stars and stripes in the eyes there with evil intent, of course. You know, all Muslims being seen like that. Or we talked about the gender thing. Here's, you know, an image that immediately evokes all kinds of usually fairly negative feelings. I mean, just sort of without you even controlling them. I mean, they just come up, right? This looks sort of horrible to most people and is associated with Islam. Or here, you know, this is a picture from Chechnya. back in the first Civil War they had, not even the most recent one, but this association of Islam with violence. The most famous example I like, this is taken from the Canadian paper, the Globe and Mail, but you might remember the bombing of the federal building in, in Oklahoma City, right? And, you know, here, blast rips U.S. heartland, blah, blah, blah. But then notice the little thing right in the next corner, Islamic militants draw suspicion. And this is old hat now. Most of you probably know that immediately suspicion was put on Islamic groups of various types for that bombing. And then lo and behold, it was one of people's own that did it, you know, people who had Christian convictions and that sort of thing. Those are some of the negative stereotypes. Here's another nice stereotype of Muslims, right? We all know Muslims are Arab, and they ride camels in the desert, right? But we already learned that only 20% of Muslims are Arab, and most Arabs don't have probably ever ridden a camel. You know that, right? Right? They drive cars like us, right?
No, they've got BMWs.
Yeah, right. So the other thing, if you think, you know, that some people think all Muslims are Arabs, and that's wrong, okay? Some people also say all Arabs are Muslims, and that's also a distortion, because a good 10% of the Arab population in the world is Christian. Okay, so you've got to be, you know, you've got to be careful about those things.
I think my favorite was said by the senator from our state. Is he a senator or representative? On public television, he was on Meet the Press, and he said that Arabs were anti-Semites.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, just a sort of a blanket statement,
well,
right? Yeah.
Plus, they are Semites.
Yeah, that's right. Know. Yeah, yeah. That's sort of a non sequitur, right? Yeah. Some of you might tweet something with you, eh? Rudolph Valentino, this is in the Sheik, eh? This dashing, handsome guy who grabs the woman he wants and goes off with her. And this is kind of an early example of how Hollywood stuff does affect our perceptions. And then more recently, of course, we have I use this Islam as threat, or the exoticness and the kind of romantic image of Islam on the other hand, the desert Arabs and so on. Here's some more examples. This is a picture taken of Muslim women. Anybody want to venture a guess where this might have been taken?
Toronto.
The other guesses?
Former Soviet republics.
Yeah. I mean, you're right. It was taken in Toronto.
So
it's right at home. I mean, this is my whole point. It's neighbor stuff now. It's not distant, far away stuff. These are, you know, Muslim women in Toronto who had a photograph taken of them here. And, we saw that heavily veiled image of the women. Well, you know, this does not mean anything about being passive and anything. This picture was taken in France during a demonstration there. And obviously this woman has no bones about asserting her views. Okay. So just the head coverings do not necessarily equal passivity or anything of that nature, right? Here are some, these are Muslim women as well. Okay. Very different now, of course, not veiled, active in the marketplace with their own, doing their own thing. This is, I think, in Malaysia or Indonesia in a market there, okay? Notice how different we're getting, different pictures. Here's a picture, this is a Muslim boy. Okay, and it says peacekeepers, so you might want to guess where that's taken.
Kosovo.
It's actually in Bosnia, so this is an older picture, but it's in that area. So, you know, man, you know, it could be one of your kids. One of my sons could. There's no difference there, right? You know? Here's a picture of a mosque, right? Islamic place of worship. Anybody want to guess where this is?
India.
Indiana.
Ohio.
Toledo, Ohio, you're right. Yeah. This is, you know, so again, this is these Islamic centers there. This isn't Egypt or Saudi Arabia, right? And, you know, this is my favorite image to do with Islam. This is a card celebrating, or a poster celebrating Ramadan, the month of fasting. It says Ramadan Kareem, and of course, if, you know, Disney can get in, that they, you know, there's Mickey Mouse lighting a candle for Ramadan, and there you go. Right? So, I guess the whole point of showing all these images is that the problem with stereotypes, of course, is you take one incident or one impression that is very specific to a particular context and time, and then you use it to paint everybody who is Islam with that brush, right? So there's one, you know, some example of terrorism or so on, and, you know, there are groups that claim to be doing this in the name of Islam. Very clearly, we can't paper, that can't be papered over. But if that is then used to say every Muslim is like that, that's a stereotype. It would be the same thing as saying, look at what those Christians did in Rwanda.
Yeah.
Butchering each other. All Christians are butcherers. They just want to kill anybody who's different from them or something. It'd be the same thing, the same kind of revulsion you would feel as a Christian, if you're a Christian, being tarred with that brush, is the same revulsion that most Muslims feel when they're tarred with the brush of terrorism or oppressors of women or so on. Because again, it's this stuff of stereotypes. But they can also laugh about it. I love second and third generation Muslims because they're going to produce a form of Islam that's going to take Islam into the 21st century in an amazing way. Because they can laugh at each other, they can be traditional about their beliefs, yet they're fully modern. And I'd like to show you at this time a video that was produced by Zarqa Nawaz. She's a filmmaker that I got to know in Regina. She got her degree at a university in Toronto. Now she's taking a little bit of time out to raise children, and that she's written some other scripts and filmed some other movies, and she's going to be working on a major production as soon as she can. But this is a film called Barbecue Muslims. Whoops.
Destroy us.
Are you boys following Nick Baldwin's thing?
Yes.
You're under arrest for the Oakville bombing.
Do you have the proof?
Your description fits the profile of some very dangerous Middle Eastern terrorists.
We're Canadian citizens. We've never even been to the Middle East. I love the West. Baseball, CNN, Slurpees, Homer Simpson.
No! I knew I should have kept that stuffed pig. No one would leave a fundamentalist leaving the pig.
So, you boys belong to a religion that locks up its women, eh? If you're referring to the practice of seclusion, that was a foreign principle introduced by the...
We have about 10 minutes left, so it sounds about right, with us, or more, or whatever. I wanted to have actually a little bit more time to talk about things, but I'm so eager to get all this stuff out, I'd be welcome for discussion or questions or anything. You had your hand up.
What's the connection? We're going to discuss the black Muslim and the Islamic culture. Mm-hmm. What's the relationship and how closely are they aligned?
Yeah. Well, there's a whole bunch of ways you can get at that whole question about black Muslims or Islam amongst blacks. First of all, with the example of Nigeria is a good one. Nigeria is a very large Muslim population. A lot of Muslims lived in Africa at the time the slave trade took place. So there's a very good chance that a pretty good proportion of the slaves that were taken from Africa and brought to the Americas, and particularly to the U.S., had Muslim background or were practicing Muslims at the time. So there's sort of, there's been some historical work done that Islam had a presence, especially amongst the black population very early on in the U.S. So there's that historical thing. When people think of black Muslims, they often think of, you said Farrakhan, right? Okay. And that's a very particular form, a very particular organization called a Nation of Islam. All right. This is an organization that arose already during the Depression era and sort of parallel with the civil rights movement in many ways. Very different from the civil rights movement in that it asserted, it was headed by a person named Elijah Muhammad, and it asserted that in order to have a legitimate place, blacks needed to cut themselves off and forge their own identity from the rest of America. And that means cutting themselves off from the majority religion, they were Islamic, not Christian, cutting themselves off economically, becoming self-sufficient. There even was talks about demanding a particular part of the states for kind of like a homeland and all that sort of stuff. But the Islam that was, and they call themselves Islam, but it's a very, very different sort of almost sectarian form of Islam. For instance, Elijah Muhammad is considered a prophet. And this is for the majority of sort of normative Islam in the world, if I can use it, that's an anathema because Muhammad was the last prophet. There are no prophets after him. And Elijah Muhammad was a prophet of Fard. I can't remember, Wallace Fard, I believe, who was considered to be an incarnation of God. And that, again, is completely different from India. Muslims would be aghast. Normative Muslims would be aghast at that notion. So there's a very different kind of, it's almost an amalgam of Christianity and Islamic ideas and so on that formed the Nation of Islam. Now, what happened is the Nation of Islam went mainstream. This would have happened sometime after the Malcolm X stuff, when he split away. Elijah Muhammad's son, the one who inherited the movement, brought it into mainstream Islam, and they adopted mainstream Islamic beliefs. But Farrakhan split off a section of that again and readopted the old, more of the old ideology again. So what you have when you're talking about Black Islam in the U.S., you've got a fairly large segment of fairly normative Sunni Muslims who belong to a variety of different movements and organizations. And then you have the Nation of Islam, which is quite a different story there. All right. So again, it's see, Islam, you know, a lot of Muslims would even say Farrakhan's Islam isn't really Islam. But let's say, and we're outsiders, we aren't the ones privileged to make those distinctions. Somebody calls himself Islamic, we include them. What it does say is how diverse Islam is. Another stereotype about Islam is that every Muslim is the same as every other one. They all believe the same thing. They all, you know, hate the West, or they all beat their wives, or whatever it is. They're all exactly the same. That's another good stereotype. Well, here you see, you know, it's a good example. There are many different Muslim groups. And that's a good example. The Nation of Islam is very particular, different.
Is there any connection between the Black Muslims and the going back to Liberia that occurred during the beginning of this?
Yeah. I don't have in my mind, Sully, all the figures and dates, but one of the famous figures who called for exodus to Africa and all that stuff, that was all tied into the genesis of movements like the Nation of Islam. They drew from that as well. Now, how direct that relationship is, I can't remember.
One of the history behind that is the problem with Liberia, because of the people that were there and then the ones that came in from the United States, and they clash.
Yeah. Now, somebody had a question here very early on. Yeah.
Okay. It wasn't me. I have a question.
Sure.
What are the fastest growing regions? Which one?
Where Islam is growing really quickly?
Toronto, Toledo.
Well, actually, Islam is, you know, growing in terms of numbers very rapidly in the West. Now, that's due to two factors. One of the big factors is immigration. That has at least been a big part of the factor in the last 20, 30 years. There's been a huge influx. There used to be these immigration barriers. I know specifically in Canada, I think it was similar in the States, where, you know, immigration from a lot of countries wasn't allowed or was discouraged and so on. And then there came time when those walls came down and there was a huge influx of immigrants from countries that were Muslim. A lot of Muslims came in. And then conversion. There's a huge high conversion rate of people in the West to Islam. So it's growing very rapidly there, but in Africa as well, Islam is growing quite well. Africa is undergoing quite a lot of change. That's the only place that Christianity is really growing like crazy as well. So.
I've been intrigued. We live in Minneapolis, and it's just been very recently that it seems to me I've seen such an explosion of women working and wearing headdresses. Mm-hmm. And they just suddenly appeared. And I've been unsure if this was the immigration, you know, finally putting people into the workforce, or if it was a change of heart both among the women and perhaps among their employers that suddenly allowed the headdress
Yeah, that's a good question.
In the workplace.
Yeah.
But it's really been interesting to watch.
Most of the Muslim women that I know wear the headscarf, and it varies. I mean, see, this is another thing. You can't say every Muslim woman covers. I mean, even on Muslim TV programs, they'll interview women, and some will have a head covering, some won't. Some will be extremely covered, others will be less extremely covered. So there's a real variation across the Muslim world about whether women wear head coverings or not, and what type they are. Most of the women that I know, Muslim women that I know who do cover, have chosen it quite on their own. In fact, sometimes in opposition to their families. Their families wanted them to fit in. They were afraid they would be ostracized and, you know, be discriminated against and so on. But they decided they would do that. And so there's sort of a second or third wave, like second and third wave feminism in the West. There's Islamic feminism as well. But it's not something that Western feminists often recognize, because it comes with veils, you know. You have people whose parents rejected the veil, and whose mothers kind of, as an act of liberation, like sort of like burning your bra or something in the 60s, took the veil off. And now their children are adopting it again, and some of them can't understand what those kids are doing, you know? but why? I mean, you know, you talk about a variant. For many of them, it is a distinctive way of identifying themselves as Islamic, as Muslims. It's a badge of their religion, and they are proud to wear the headdress and let people know that they are Muslim. You know? That's a big part of it, part of their identity. Secondly, a lot of them prefer, will say that they wear the headdress because they would prefer not to be harassed. And, well, you know, I mean, it's true that women are often, you know, if you're dressed in certain ways, you tend to be, you know, that people experience provocative behavior, harassment, and so on. And they just say, well, that's something in the public space. I don't need to deal with that. I'd like people to just deal with me as a human person, deal with me because of my job, because of my skills, and so on, without the diversions or the distortions that can come about by my figure or my hair or anything like that. And so that's sometimes the argument that's heard as well. Now, that isn't true probably of some traditional Muslim places in the world, where it's expected of girls to start wearing a veil at a certain time, where you'd really be bucking the trend if you didn't. But certainly there's North American experiences like that. There was this question here first, and then I'll back to you.
What little bit I know about the Islamic religion, is that the right way to say it?
Sure, yeah.
Is I like, but then some of the, I guess the subjugation of women in certain countries has really bothered me. The obvious one is that what's happening in Afghanistan. My book discussion group, I was trying to ask my husband if he could remember the title, but we read a book about a woman from a high-class family in Saudi, and about her, it was an autobiography, her experiences, and also, in addition to the subjugation, the idealization of the males of the family, and how they could get away with incredible sexual misbehavior, that the women would be killed or put into rooms and never let out for minute about them. I'd be interested in that.
Yeah, well, you know, for instance, a good example of that is I'm involved in a network that's headed by a Pakistani Muslim woman, Rifat Hassan, who teaches religious studies in Louisville, Kentucky, and she's originally from Pakistan, a very learned woman, and she is aghast at the treatment of women, where women are indiscriminately killed if they're suspected of a sexual impropriety to preserve the honor of the family. Okay, this is a widespread practice, and Pakistan is probably the worst offender in this regard. So this is honor killings, right? Now, it's very interesting because on one level, there might be a lot of the Muslim masses who don't make a distinction between their religion and this practice, for instance. But it's very clear from any academics Muslim or more learned Muslims that there is no Islamic justification for the practice. But you know how things go. I mean, practices of abhorrent practices are often justified and legitimized for religious reasons. That, you know, this happens amongst Christians too, actually. You know, that and in fact, honor killing is a custom that was very common in the Mediterranean basin and actually used to be practiced by Greeks and by Christian groups just as well, like that, where the honor of the family is bound up with the sexual purity of its womb. All right, and that's, you know, that's sort of the cultural space. One of the cultural spaces that Islam inhabits, and it becomes a problem. It's not a problem in other parts of the Muslim world, right? But it's a problem, definitely in Jordan and Pakistan and other countries that share that orbit. So, yeah, you know, and this is where the stereotype problem comes in, because, you know, you don't want to, you can't whitewash that. And you have Muslims like Rifat Hassan saying, "Whoa, I don't want," and she's gotten into hot water like crazy. All these Pakistanis are mad at her. You're hanging her dirty laundry up in public, and isn't this horrible? And you're getting all these non-Muslims involved in writing letters to the, you know, the general who's in charge in Pakistan and all stuff. You're trying to do all this stuff, and it makes us look bad, and it's encouraging all these negative stereotypes about us. Don't do this, you know, it's something that we wanted. But she's saying, no, we got it. This is, we, you know, we are behooven as Muslims to act against this injustice because this is not Islamic. So, yeah, but that happens. You get those associations. But I think the important thing is to explore it further and try to figure out, you know, where is it coming from? How is it justified? Who's justifying it? Is this Islam really or not? Now, I know there was a question
but
here.
In connection with that, I think there's a lot of stuff that goes on that's purely male attitude type stuff, you know, in the Sudan, particularly the female circumcision.
Yes, yes.
And there's a law against it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but it's so inbred into the society that it's very... But in Oman, there's a law against wearing a veil.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, so it's not...
And Turkey has had a lot of problems because they wanted no veils either.
And before the revolution, the women in Iran almost never wore a black chador.
Right.
It was always flowered and bright. And
There's a lot of diversity, and it's always important to look at the different regions. Yeah.
I was remembering one of the television shows about Muslim father who's from the Middle East, and the first pictures you see are of the little girl who's the child of this family, and it's her birthday, and she is down at the ocean, and she's playing in what looks totally inappropriate because she is very veil-robed and trying to play in the water. Kids obviously having a great time, but I said to myself, boy, that would be tough to be a little girl in that culture. Okay, the next thing that happens is her American mother kidnaps her, and the next picture she's seeing is she's been brought to this wonderful life in California. And I'm looking at the bathing suit this little girl is playing in the water, and I'm saying to myself, that is really inappropriate.
Poor kid can't win.
These parents actually could not get it right.
Yeah. And,
really hard to think about cultural, and each parent thought they were doing what was
right
for this little girl, and each of them so culture bound, and of course they didn't have my cultural standards, so neither of
them. Actually, like usually, that's very unusual for the small children, like the small girls, to be, that's not a worry. It's usually when they hit puberty that it's either imposed or they adopt it themselves, or there's some sort of pressure onto it. Now, culturally, that does change. I know Zarka's little girl, the imam in her mosque, because he's an import from India, right? And he's very traditional. He's learning. He's really trying hard to learn. And he kept, you know, saying to her, you know, you should get veiled. And she said, I don't have to, you know. And her mother said, well, when she decides, that's when, and he's coming around to that, you know. Right? It's usually when they reach puberty that becomes a concern, you know, about mixing of the sexes and that sort of thing. Yeah.
How are Muslims struggling with this confluence of culture and religion.
Oh yeah.
Are they attempting to try to pull the two apart?
Oh yeah.
So there's an ongoing conversation.
There is a lot of ferment in the Muslim world on many different levels. I mentioned Islamic feminism. Mm-hmm. Very unknown, like that's sort of Islamic feminism, don't seem. But that there are women, they have their own Quran study groups, they are figuring out the religious law for themselves, and they are coming speaking out with authority against some of the male leaders who, you know, the whole problem with the West and Western culture and global Western culture is really struggling with that, because secularization doesn't seem to have done all that great things in Muslimized to North America. And so why do we want to adopt that wholesale, you know? So there's a lot of, you know, we want to preserve our traditional, you know, strong emphasis on the family, for instance, and so on. So there is, economically, how do we have a just social order? You know, global capitalism and sort of venture capitalism and all this sort of dot commerce stuff like that doesn't seem to be working for it. It impoverishes people, there's a struggle about that. How much do we adopt of that? How much of that is good or bad? So there's a lot of internal struggle in the Muslim world, a lot of discussion and questioning. Politically, a lot of Muslim countries, you know, have suffered under dictatorships or military regimes and are struggling towards forms of democracy. Iran is more democratic, if you want to measure it by party politics and elections, than it ever was before the revolution.
Yes, with the Shah. Right?
Yeah, the Shah was an absolute, he had secret police, it was horrid. But, I mean, there are dozens of political parties, there's women vote in droves. In fact, the reason that the more moderate guy got in was because of the women and youth vote. All these young kids grow up without the revolution, they don't want to continue the regime. And, you know, there'll be a transformation in Iran, hopefully. Very likely, because of that.
What are the touchstone issues then about this intersection? Is it? You mentioned social justice.
Social justice.
And women's issues.
Women's issues are women issues are the lightning rod of a lot of this.
Okay. Even within the Muslim world.
Often within the Muslim world as well. Yeah.
I mean,
it's definitely the lightning rod in the Western world.
Yeah, but Muslims, aside from us.
But it's also a big lightning rod in the. It's also a focus for in the Muslim world, and then economic and social justice is a really big part. Yep. Okay. We have to cut it off. So. The next session is tomorrow at 10:45, I believe, and I'm looking at basic Muslim beliefs. So if you're interested.